Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today I'm very pleased to have as my guest the editor-in-chief of one of the best magazines covering politics and government in the nation. The magazine is the Washington Monthly, which is independent, nonprofit, and based in Washington, D.C. It's described as center-left, but hasn't been shy at all about going after sacred cows from the right and the left. And I can attest to that. I like this magazine, and I'm a longtime subscriber and recommend that our listeners take a look at it if you're not reading it, subscribing already. My guest is Paul Glastras, who's a former reporter for U.S. News & World Report, speechwriter for President Bill Clinton. And as I say, he's the editor-in-chief at the Washington Monthly. Paul, thank you so much for taking some time to come on.
Robin, thanks for having me on.
You know, I had planned a kind of a retrospective look at Joe Biden's first 8 months in office, and we've had the withdrawal from Afghanistan and all the controversy about that over the weekend. And so I thought I still want to look at Biden's first months, but kind of do it, add that to the mix. First of all, I guess, what are your impressions of the Biden administration's decision to withdraw and the way in which it was done?
You know, Robin, I'm probably in the great minority of people who didn't think that it a withdrawal was wise. And I, you know, as with all things in Afghanistan, you have to be humble and admit you don't know what you don't know, and that it's hard to predict outcomes. But, you know, my own opinion was that a pretty reasonable amount of troops not involved in combat could have kept the situation in check for a good long time. I could be wrong, but, you know, that is what was happening, and I didn't see the need, other than mass, you know, public opinion, to pull out. But, you know, that was a decision. And, you know, at least in those early days, it looked like it was happening in you know, the most nightmarish way, with the government forces just disappearing and the Taliban routing the government's forces and taking over and entering Kabul. Things seems to have stabilized a little bit. The Taliban allowing the U.S. troops to secure the airport and expeditiously help American personnel out and some Afghan refugees. We'll see how long that goes on. But, you know, whether it was well orchestrated or poorly orchestrated, I think the result would have been the same. And I think anyone with a familiarity with the conditions there and the war so far would have predicted a pretty complete rout by the Taliban.
You know, it's strange, and the question I have, and a lot of other people have asked the same question and concern, and I think it's 100% legitimate. Why, after 20 years and all the money spent, why wasn't the Afghan military better prepared? I know they were going to be backed up by U.S. air power, but it seems like they would have put up a little more of a fight there. Is there, I mean, do you share that thought, and could something have been done differently? And what, I guess the broader concern is just the concern about our intelligence capabilities over there as well.
You know, I've never been to Afghanistan. I'm not a military professional. My guess is as good as anybody's on the any of your listeners. But for what it's worth, if you've been following the news over the last 10 or 15 years, it's absolutely no surprise that the Afghan military is very weak. They're drawing personnel from alcoholics and criminals, and it's not a great pool of, only a tiny percentage of the force is literate. It's an extremely poor country. The whole population knows the government is a kleptocracy, and absent Americans backing them up, no one felt that the government could beat the Taliban. So as soon as it was clear the Americans were we're leaving. You know, who wants to fight for a government you don't believe in with comrades, many of whom are, you know, are going to cut and run anyway? It just, you can't run an operation that way. And I don't think this was an intelligence failure. I think we've been, you know, hearing these, this scenario predicted as one possible one for years and years.
So it's hard. It might be a little more challenging perhaps now to rate President Biden's first months in office with this hanging over us. Who knows how this will shake out? It could be something that, in the election cycle is used against him effectively and the Democrats. It could be something people forget about down the road. But I'll ask you on.
Yeah,
I
think that ladder is really worth exploring. This is happening in, you know, the dog days of August 2021. Depending on the size of the refugee population problem and what fallout that has in the broader region in Europe and elsewhere in the United States, it could be huge, or it could be something that in, you know, October, November of 2022 just isn't on people's mind.
So looking at Biden's first months in office, I think it's close to 8 months, perhaps somewhere in there, and maybe setting this aside for the minute. But how would you rate his inaugural time in office? And, he came in under certainly surprising circumstances where the Democrats captured both of those Georgia Senate seats, where he had a very thin working majority in the Senate. But how do you feel he's done so far? And I know your magazine had some very good writing on some folks offering some ideas on policy initiatives for him to consider during his term.
Yeah, we sure did. And I'd love to talk about those. The weak hand he had, that is, you know, no margin for error really in either the House or the Senate. An opposition party going in a very weird direction, still controlled by the defeated former president, and coming on the heels of an insurrectionist movement with a massive pandemic, economic decline, long term as well as short term. I mean, it was an astonishingly tough period to take the reins of the superpower. And I think, given the circumstances, given the hand he's been awfully good. The White House has, we can go through all kinds of things that might have been better, and certainly this mess in Afghanistan, we'll just have to see how it plays out. But I think they grasped what leverage they had and used it as well as I can imagine it being used. He's kept the Democrats together. He pushed through a massive early aid program that kept people in their homes and in their apartments, and he's seen wage increases. He's seen an increasing employment. He's seen, been blessed with a decent stock market, as were the last two presidents, and has had some success with this bipartisan infrastructure bill, which his predecessor couldn't get through the Senate. The most exciting thing to me, because this is something that the Washington Monthly has been writing about now for well over a decade and a half, he has seized the reins of antitrust. He has become the antitrust president. He's going after the high concentration of companies in industry after industry, from high tech to agriculture. And I think that is not only the wise thing to do for the future of the country, for jobs, for growth, for wages, but is also politically very good territory for him to stake out.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because that's an issue certainly that we heard a lot of the presidential candidates talking about in Iowa. I had most of them on my show, and this became an issue where they were talking about it, especially with big ag and big tech is particularly salient issues across Iowa. Your magazine has had some excellent articles about this, and one in particular I remember, Paul, was about St. Louis and the impact on the city of St. Louis of merging companies that one in particular was the airlines. I remember I used to fly when I went to Washington through St. Louis. Now you've got to go through Chicago, but in the beer industry, in the banking industry, in the airline industry, the impact it's had on St. Louis. So what are some ideas? Is this just going to be purely legal where lawsuits are filed, or are there incentives that can be provided at the grassroots level to have Main Street kind of fight back a little bit?
Well, those are all great questions. Let me just say, St. Louis is my hometown, so the stories we wrote about St. Louis were very personal to me. And yeah, you know, St. Louis went from having, you know, a couple of dozen Fortune 500 companies in 1980 when I went off to college to having about nine now. And, you know, the city's grown very slowly, not much at all, actually. It's actually become a hub of startups, but because of the locking up of high-tech markets, startups get bought out by the big monopolists and get moved to San Francisco and Seattle and St. Louis, which puts lots of effort into helping those startups grow, you know, is left home in the bag. So it's a terrible, terrible situation we have where we're literally emptying out heartland cities like the Quad Cities, like Des Moines, like St. Louis, and not to mention the rural areas with the tremendous crushing of the family farm and the squeezing of both inputs and outputs by agribusiness. All of this can be reversed. All of this was the result of decisions made and not made in Washington, D.C. And, you know, Joe Biden, I don't think when he was through the Quad Cities, I don't know if you had a interview, he was not talking about this stuff. It was Amy Klobuchar. It was Cory Booker. It was Elizabeth Warren. But Biden has gotten religion, and just a few weeks ago put out an amazing set of executive orders encouraging agencies throughout the government to use the powers they had to bring more competition to markets, you know, including agribusiness. And we'll see how that plays out. But that is a very big deal. There's a lot of inherent powers from old laws that have not been used for decades that he can use to do a lot of deconsolidating of markets and to open up space for entrepreneurs, for family farmers, for smaller banks, for all kinds of enterprise. But there's legislation being pushed through Congress, too, to strengthen those laws, lots of it. So this will play out over the next few years. But even without the legislation, Biden has the power to do a lot of good.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Paul Glastris, who's the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, just a fantastic magazine based in Washington. It covers politics and government. I'm a subscriber. Check it out. I think you'll like it. They self-describe as leaning center-left, but don't let that, if you're a Republican or conservative, dissuade you from taking a look, because they've taken on some common ideas on the left as well. And again, it's the reason I enjoy reading the magazine. Paul's been talking about the Biden administration and its tough decisions in Afghanistan that took place over the weekend and kind of the first months of the Biden administration. We've talked about an issue that his magazine has been in the forefront on. And that is the issue of antitrust enforcement and consolidation in the economy. I wanted to follow up with that, Paul. I mean, I thought it's fascinating. One idea that's been talked about that's happened organically is the beer industry. We all know this, those of us that like to have a beer, but these craft beers have risen up and kind of become very popular locally versus the big the big distributors, Miller Lite, Budweiser, that have consolidated. But are there ways, that this can be done more granularly at the local level through government incentives, perhaps? Any ideas on that?
Oh, absolutely. The beer industry looks like it's robust and full of competition. You have this explosion of craft beers. That is an indication of just how much talent and energy and entrepreneurial drive there is in this country. Every town of any now has, you know, multiple craft breweries. The problem is, A, they don't have the distribution, right? The distribution is locked up by conglomerates, and those that do well get bought up by the InBevs and the two or three companies that control the market. So if we could go back to the way the market was structured just when you and I were kids, right? Certainly back the way it was structured in the 40s and 50s during a great era of beer, you could have those craft beers making a lot more money, eating into the market, you know, selling their products more widely. It would be marvelous. So just in the beer industry, you see both potential for recreating competitive markets and the limits that we now have with consolidation.
Now, one fear, let me play devil's advocate. One fear that's voiced quite a bit is that somewhat goes back to the Robert Bork theory that consolidation isn't necessarily bad. It can create efficiencies. And if you start breaking up these big tech companies, Amazon perhaps, we might be paying more and prices go up. Do you feel assured that wouldn't necessarily happen in our economy?
You know, Robert Bork, you mentioned him. He was the famous jurist who was denied a Supreme Court seat, conservative University of Chicago guy, wrote a book in the late 70s called The Antitrust Paradox that argued just that monopolies paradoxically raise prices, don't lower them, because a monopoly can use efficiencies and to be more, you know, use scale to be more efficient and then lower prices. Look, people who've looked at the antitrust, people who've worked in antitrust going back to the 19th century understood that monopolies have that scale is important. It has to be factored into how you structure markets. But almost all subsequent studies of Robert Bork's theory has proven that he is wrong. The more consolidated an industry, the higher the prices, which is what we all were taught in economics classes, you know, years ago. And, you know, his book provided no evidence for that. It was pure theory. And it seemed to be persuasive to people at the time, but it's just wrong. The one area where it seems right is in high tech, in the sense that you don't pay, at least out of your pocket, for Facebook. You know, they're taking your data, right? They're mining your data. You are paying. And it has other deleterious effects, you know, from being vectors of disinformation and Russian bots to you know, crushing local newspapers by stealing their ad money. So the argument for almost nobody wants to be said, wants to be, even the people who are lobbyists for monopoly companies don't want to be labeled pro-monopoly, because we've labeled them such and gotten blowback because they don't like the term. There's really not good argument. There really aren't good arguments for monopoly. And there haven't been for hundreds of years. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations argued against monopoly. So the case is pretty cut and dry, but, you know, there's a lot of money locked up in those big companies that are trying to defend them.
I saw where you recently this year celebrated your 20th anniversary of being the editor-in-chief at the Washington Monthly, and it got me thinking, you know, your term there as editor-in-chief has coincided with, well, the Afghan war and our involvement in Afghanistan, and really, it seems like something's happened in the last 20 years. I'm older, and I go back, back to, you know, the John Kennedy era and after that and all. But it seems like the last 20 years, just things have gotten off the rail. And I'm not sure, you know, we had the Great Recession, and most guests I have on here, economists, public officials, policy folks, it just seems like something happened in the wake of that Great Recession to us, economically, politically, culturally, that we're still grappling with, and led to the rise, I think, of Trump and Sanders and this populist movement. Have you had, do you get time to kind of sit back and take all this in, that what's happened and where we may be going forward here with this? It just seems like we never recovered from that Great Recession on several different levels.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I mean, you know, beginning with Afghanistan, you know, you and I go back to, at least I was a kid during Vietnam, and I remember it. Vietnam went off the rails. Like at the moment where Vietnam became a problem that, you know, literally ripped the country apart was in the spring of 1965 when Lyndon Johnson started sending ground troops in. And a lot of people said, don't do it, don't do it. And he did it anyway, in part because he didn't, he was afraid the Republicans would paint him as soft on the communists. And it turned out to be just a disastrous decision. The moment when Afghanistan similarly went off the rails was in December 2001. And you remember Tora Bora.
Yeah.
And Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda colleagues were trapped in these caves in a remote part of Afghanistan, semi-surrounded by Americans and their Afghan warlord allies. And because Donald Rumsfeld and the Bush administration took the wrong lesson from Vietnam, they sent in insufficient troops, and Osama bin Laden got away. Also, they were eager to pivot to the Iraq War, and they were saving their troops for the Iraq War, which we didn't have enough of when we went in also. So had Johnson avoided ground troops in Vietnam, all of history, political history for decades later would have been different. Had George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld put in sufficient troops, you know, in Afghanistan in those first months, you know, and not invaded Iraq, all of history would have been different. You know, it really does come down to these pivot points. You know, the recession, the Great Recession, was the culmination of a lot of trends, many of them having to do with consolidation, right? What was the collapse of the economy other than, you know, the financial markets, which are highly concentrated, locking up? And, you know, one of the undoings of the Democrats was Obama not doing enough to break up the big banks. I understand why they didn't do it. They were afraid they're trying to get pump life into the economy. But politically and in other ways, it was devastating for the Democrats. You know, we're in a very precarious point in our national life, with such different worldviews on either side of the political divide. I think we're walking a knife edge as a democracy.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it seems like we look up, and of course, part of this is the influence of social media, which can be absolutely cancerous on our country. The more and more I look at it, but we like to beat up our politicians, and they deserve it a lot of times. And we can be cynical towards them, but I guess we've just got a couple minutes here remaining. Are there some fresh faces out there that maybe our listeners haven't even seen, but if not, that's fine, seen or heard of. But are there some people up and coming through the ranks on both parties that you see that might offer fresh perspectives and for us to keep our eyes on here in the next couple of years as people that can help break through some of the troubling issues we're facing, not just on the hyperpartisanship and gridlock, but also representing new ideas that, you know, can maybe even cross party lines to appeal to more of us?
You know, I don't know about the latter, but I do think that just in terms of talent to keep your eye on short-term and long-term, I think on the Democratic side, you know, watch Val Demings, who, you know, running for the Senate in Florida. You know, former has a deep criminal justice background, African American, you know, has a good record on police, but also is tough on crime, could be the Eric Adams of Florida. It'll be a tough race, but you know, Florida is a state that Democrats have done poorly in, but by very small margins over recent cycles. And I think John Ossoff, the freshman senator from Georgia, is a very bright guy. Watched his campaign very carefully, and just an immensely disciplined political campaigner and a strategic thinker. He is now the chairman of the subcommittee on investigations. Freshman senators almost never do kinds of assignments, but he has a background as an investigative journalist, and it's a great match of his experience and talent and committee assignment. And so over the years, I think you're going to see that guy go places. On the Republican side, right in your backyard, Marionette Miller Meeks of the Iowa 2nd District, who won that by 6 votes, certainly I don't know, you know, that she is, I don't know enough, honestly, about her her capacities as a politician and candidate, but certainly that race is one that we're, you know, everybody should keep their eye on. And then the other Republican I would really recommend people learn more about is Ken Buck from Colorado, the congressman from the 4th District of Colorado. He is the ranking member on the Judiciary Subcommittee on Antitrust. So he has that portfolio that I was talking about of antitrust and competition policy. And he's very smart, and he isn't exactly where the Democrats are, but he sure isn't where the monopolists are. And I think that is the right policy for the country. And I also think politically, whichever party can make itself the champion of it is going to, over the long term, succeed politically.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. I think we could keep talking for quite a while here, but I've got to cut it short and maybe have you back at some point in the future to talk about some other key issues. It's been fascinating, and congratulations again on the 20-year anniversary, editor-in-chief at the Washington Monthly. Paul, our guest today has been Paul Glastris, who is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, and we've had a very interesting discussion. And Paul, thank you again for taking the time to be with us.
It is my pleasure. I'd love to come back.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.